can I please share something with you? This was written by Margaret, who is a major in the Army Reserve. She has made poppies with us in Canberra. She came and planted, including in her fatigues. And at the end, she posted a beautiful photo of the poppies, and then she wrote this. I hope I get through it. As I let the poppy sticks fall to maybe look a little less formal, a bit more natural for our planting, I got to thinking about the men who may have literally fallen like my poppy stems, at once running and then not, ducking for cover, only to be spun cartwheeling to the sky, perhaps knocked senseless by artillery fire or buried deep in a trench collapse. Such cheery things are these poppies with bright centres and sparkling bits and bobs I'm sure the birds will like. But then tucked away, shyly drab and wilting, are the faded Fromelle poppies, worn from their journey. "Don't forget me, Cobber," they whisper between the newly minted stems. "Look after my missus and kids," they plead between the sparkles and tinsel yarn. Although the poppy fields are silent, their mute testimony is loud. From the hands and hearts of many came these new poppies who shout to the sky, "We remember you, you, and you, all of you, lest we forget."
Yes, well done. That says all. I love that post.
Welcome to episode 4 of From a Whisper to a Bang, a podcast series about remembrance for the Australian War Memorial. My name is Megan Spencer. And you just heard Meredith Attilamile. We met at the memorial in Canberra last October at the launch of the 62,000 poppies display, the colourful centrepiece of the memorial's 2018 commemorative program, which marked the centenary of the armistice of the First World War.
Every one of these poppies is a repository of love, of a noble memory.
Meredith's part of the dedicated group of volunteers who helped make and make happen this epic display of 62,000 woolen poppies, hand-knitted and crocheted in Canberra, around Australia, with some even from overseas, then planted in the grounds of the memorial.
Whilst this is a tribute to those fallen, this is also a tribute to the people that came together as a community to create it, and I'm so very proud.
Each handmade poppy, made with care, represented an Australian life lost in World War I, just as the bells in this track from the Digger's Requiem do, which accompanied the installation. We'll hear from Meredith again a little later on today, and also from some of the other poppy ladies. But for now, let's rewind and pick up the story from where we left off last episode in From a Whisper to a Bang. So it's October 2017, and after close to 3 years of living in Germany, with much of the last year of it researching and retracing the footsteps of my soldier ancestors, Harry, my grandfather, a POW in Germany during World War II, and Richard, his older brother, killed at 18 in World War I in Belgium, now my husband, Oliver, and I are finally on our way back to live again in Australia. It's been a long and emotional pilgrimage for me, for both of us really, with many miles travelled and much time reflecting on family ties and lineage, and most importantly, for me at least, contemplating, exploring and discovering the role of remembrance. But in many ways, this journey's only just beginning.
Ladies and gentlemen, very shortly we'll be ready for departure, so all your mobile phones and electronic devices should be switched off. Please make sure your seatbelt.
As I settle into my seat, clip the belt, and wait for the plane to take off, my mind goes over the many conversations I've had so far about the value of remembrance and how important it is, especially now in a time where extremism, individualism, and tribalism are on the rise and changing the very fabric of the world. So it all felt very close up living in Europe. War's not a video game, I think to myself. It has very real, very human consequences. Which is something the hundreds of Stolpersteine, stumble stones in and around Berlin reminded Oliver and I of daily, walking the cobblestone streets of the city and finding at our feet so often small brass plaques etched with the names of Holocaust victims in front of the houses from where they were taken. Tiny yet inescapable and stark reminders of the costs of war, and there are 70,000 of them now all over Europe. Same with our thousands of war memorials and monuments in Australia, an estimated 4,700 plus right across the country, the bearers of collective memory, as the late historian Ken Inglis called them. Commemorative objects urging us with every name and every dedication in every town to not only remember the fallen, those who served and their sacrifices, but the communal cost of war, always, always. So 100 years on from the end of the war to end all wars, in what is now a very different world, a busy, incessantly moving world, do we take the time, make the time, very often nowadays, to slow down enough and to do that, to remember? Is it possible that we could be forgetting the lessons of the past? So today we're going to go travelling again, but at home in Australia. Oliver and I have family and friends dotted around the country, so as we make our way to them to reunite, I jump at the chance to explore remembrance in various places and with various people, meeting and talking to more historians, pilgrims and people just like Meredith, but back here at home. And I'll also explore the idea of whether remembrance and empathy might be able to help keep the peace. So lots of questions, lots of listening. Time for me to again put one foot in front of the other, and I hope you'll join me.
Singapore goes down in flames with the 8th Division fighting to the end. There's nothing to stop the fire of war spreading southward. The fire reaches Darwin on February the 19th, 1942. That day, 140 Japanese aircraft carry the war to Australia's doorstep.
I suppose sometimes it's about not forgetting the bloke next door who went off to do the right thing and never came back. And you're just like him. We're all just like him or her. Went off to do the right thing, as you thought, or the wrong thing maybe, I don't know. And that was it. Nobody thinks when they're a young person that they're going to die. They think it's not going to happen to us, not going to happen to me, or in fact my mates, it's going to happen to somebody we don't know, which isn't true.
So our first stop is Darwin, Australia's northernmost capital city, actually the place where Oliver and I first met, Larrakia country. I learned so much when I was living and working there, especially how intrinsic war remembrance is to Darwin culture, a city which, post-Federation, has had to rebuild itself twice, once famously after Cyclone Tracy in 1974, but before that, after being bombed by the Japanese military during World War II.
Japanese bombers come on in relentless formations, almost unopposed.
Dr. Tom Lewis, OAM, who you heard talking just a moment ago about remembrance, is a military historian and a prolific author, really one of the go-to people in Australia when it comes to the war history of Northern Australia. He's also an historian who's served in the military, nowadays a retired naval officer who was deployed to Baghdad in 2006. Tom says that his war experience made him into a better historian.
Warfare is surreal. It's almost impossible to describe unless you've been there. But I wrote a book called Lethality in Combat after I came back, and it's about the true behaviour of people in battle It's particularly nasty stuff and confrontational. I think a lot of people don't like it. Certainly quite a few people told me. Because it deals with the extremely unpleasant aspects of war and the behaviour that people sometimes engage in because they think it's necessary. So seeing some of those things up close and personal, and having my own weapons that I was carrying around and seeing attacks and being involved in a few and getting shelled and mortared as I did occasionally, it certainly makes you evaluate things a little bit differently. I suppose I've come out a bit of it. Sometimes I sound almost a bit flippant about warfare. It's sort of really a defence mechanism. It's not to be disrespectful of those people who've died, rather the reverse. It's just to say, look, you don't know the half of it. Warfare is an extremely strange, surreal, difficult, different experience. And after a while, you think the collateral cost is so dreadful that you would do anything to avoid it. And it's almost something that's the civilians and the military are two worlds apart. That's quite often why you get this separation between people on Anzac Day, and you get people say, oh, Dad never spoke about the war, but their dad is down the pub with his mates and they're talking about the war non-stop. You can't stop them, they're talking under wet concrete. It's because the people he's talking to, or she there these days, understand. They've been there.
Yeah, and ditto for my grandfather. While Harry, my dad told me, never took part in Anzac Day events, he did seek out the comfort of friends who'd served, who understood what happened to him as a soldier and as a POW in World War II. And they would talk and drink for hours.
I'd been back from the war for 2-3 years, I think, and I was at Canungra in Queensland doing a course. And somebody told me that a wing commander who I used to serve with, I was a Navy lieutenant commander, was in the same building, and we hunted each other down. We both started hunting each other down at the same time. She's about 5'6" and I'm a 6'1" sort of huge bloke. And when we met each other, we sort of lifted each other off the ground just about, and we got a bit emotional. And we went and had a bit of a cry around the corner because that's what you do. I mean, she and I got shelled together. And you don't forget that.
War has indeed come to Australia. For months, the AIF have made plans for its defence. Infantry man its trenches. Barbed wire covers its beaches. Darwin must be held at all costs.
My visit to Tom comes at the end of a particularly busy year for him as the historian for The Territory Remembers, the Northern Territory Government's program commemorating the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Darwin and the defence of the Great North of Australia, as Tom calls it.
In the Far East, the wheel is turning toward a sudden climax. The 2nd AIF stands ready for any test.
Tom's job is to help people remember not just the 19th of February 1942, but the rest of the bombing of Darwin's story, which often gets forgotten. To this day, many of us still don't realise the full extent of the attacks on Australia's north and just how long they went for. It wasn't a singular Pearl Harbor-style incursion. The campaign, Tom tells me, went for well over 2 years.
One thing I do notice, though, is that Australians are fascinated by it all. And after that initial cry of, why didn't I know this, dies down, they are quite interested and voracious readers. And they buy books and they devour films about what happened up here in World War II, and so they should.
Tom and I also discuss the grim total war policy of World War I and how it led to World War II. I find Tom's brilliant and blunt insider perspective fascinating. And while his knowledge of the history is encyclopedic, his message is very much about empathy.
I think empathy is of fundamental importance, and it's not understood. 3 years ago, the federal government, the Northern Territory government, the Darwin City Council and the Australian Japanese Association all cooperated to scatter the ashes of a dead Japanese aviator's wife. In Darwin Harbour, because that's where her husband had died in 1943 when two of our Spitfires shot down his diner and killed him and his navigator. And she always wanted her ashes to be scattered next to her first husband. She survived the war, she remarried, but she always remembered him. And when she died about 8 years ago, the ashes were there after the Japanese cremation, and the family baffled as to how do we carry out Mum's wishes. And one thing led to the other. Eventually, I was able to help arrange the ceremony, and everybody came to the party. And several Japanese people of that family flew out to Australia, the first time ever, with no English. They were met by us. They were taken onto a Navy vessel. They were taken out to sea. A Navy chaplain was there. We gave them an afternoon tea when they came back to land. And we did everything we could for them. And I think the Japanese were a bit baffled as to why we do that. We understand your loss, is what we're saying. We understand that your bloke died in a far-off country and nobody remembers him except you. Well, we do too. He is lying in our soil, and as Ataturk said of our people who died at Gallipoli, he is part of our soil. So, Mums of Australia, don't worry about your Johnnies, because they lie alongside our Mehmets now. And at the end of the day, we're all human beings, and we can put aside some of those ancestral fights, and we can understand that after 75 years, we can have not to forget, we'll never forget, but we can forgive. And I think that's a fundamental importance. I certainly will go out of my way, and I have on many occasions, to try and do this. And although I was a soldier myself, a naval officer dressed up in body armour and stire, so not really a soldier, but on dry land, I had a lot of people shoot at me in the Baghdad War. I didn't enjoy it at all. And I gave as good as I got. I don't hate all Iraqis, and it's what I did as a professional soldier. So, yeah, it's important to get empathy with your former enemy, and you treat your enemy with dignity too. So, they were somebody's brother, father, son, sister, daughter, and they came to a sometimes bitter end in a far-off country. They were us, and that's why they should be remembered.
Oh, empathy for your enemy and remembrance of the other. That takes a lot of courage and understanding, I think, to get there, to humanise rather than demonise, in spite of what they did to you during wartime, even on your own doorstep. Or maybe it's just common human decency. And it reminds me of a few things I learned from another soldier, Harry, my grandfather, reading his war memoir. Amid the dark clouds of combat or hardship as a POW, every now and then, regard for his oppressors, as he called them, would lighten his story a little, such as towards the German paratroopers who were shot out of the sky when the Luftwaffe attacked the Allies on Crete. It was like a pigeon shoot at times, he wrote. Some of them would be hanging from trees or electric light wires, some even upside down. Or for the little old guard who secretly let Harry rest on a work detail near Munich when he was terribly sick with nephritis. Or the German officer on Crete who secretly gave him new shoes just after Harry had become a prisoner of war.
Later, an English-speaking Jerry called me into the house. He asked would I like a pair of shoes, as you could see my army boots had seen better days. This Jerry then gave me some tin herring, bully beef, raisins, and a loaf of stale bread, and a pack of cigarettes, which was good of him, I thought. Before leaving, the Jerry had a good look about, and saw that we were alone. We shook hands, and he wished me good luck. I was near tears as I thanked him.
As Tom says, war is a strange, surreal, difficult experience. And sometimes remembrance of it can be as well. So what's this empathy thing I keep banging on about?
In effect, it's to recreate over here some sense of the experience the other person is having over there. And that's kind of a fancy way to put it, but that's the essence of empathy.
This is Dr. Rick Hansen. Rick's a senior fellow at the Greater Good Science Center at the University of California in Berkeley and a world-renowned author and neuropsychologist. His book, Hardwiring Happiness, is a bestseller, and he's in great demand as a speaker, both at home in the US and abroad, giving talks at international events and conferences, such as the one I meet him at in Melbourne.
So if we're resonating with or tuning into the actions of others, it's a very efficient way to get a sense from the inside out of what that other person is doing and what their intentions are.
Rick's work deals with both head and heart, with empathy a big part of it. And as it turns out, it's one of his favourite subjects to talk about.
That's the essence of empathy. And it's a fundamental human quality. It's morally neutral. It's when we bring in compassion or other morally positive qualities that empathy can be really used for good.
In and of itself, empathy is not necessarily a good or a bad quality. We've all heard about those people who cognitively understand empathy and then go ahead and use it to manipulate somebody or do bad things against them without a second thought. And Rick told me that even magpies, very social animals, use empathy to swindle their fellow birds out of food, using their very innate sense of empathy or taking the perspective of another. So it's what you do with it that counts. He also says that empathy evolved as a survival mechanism.
Why? Well, animals that could infer the intentions of predators, prey, and others of their kind were more likely to live to see the sunrise and pass on genes that could pass on genes. And then with the development of very social animals like birds and mammals, and then very, very social animals, primates, being able to really tune into the states of mind, the states of being, including emotions of others in your band, would be really, really useful for raw survival.
So I'm making this project as what I'm calling a journey in historical empathy. From a man I didn't know very well, my grandfather, and visiting sites in Germany where he was a prisoner of war and trying to kind of recreate in my mind and my heart his story and what happened to him and what he went through. So I'm curious to know what you think the role of remembrance is in the realm of including empathy in that. Is it important for us?
The phrase empathic imagination is something that is at the heart of this, I think. And it gets at the two-way process of empathy and the ways in which greater empathy can develop, including for oneself. For example, through understanding ourselves better, you become better at imagining how it is for others. Go the other way, as you imagine how it could be for other people, including someone who is having an experience that you haven't had. Like for myself, I've never served in the military, I've never been in combat, I've never been a POW. And yet there are aspects of your grandfather's life that just from the little tiny, tiny bit I know, I can imagine, and then especially if I were to learn more about his life through your work, for example, or as we might learn about the lives of others through fiction, accurate kind of descriptive fiction that's getting at something true. As we imagine what it's like to be them, and when I say imagine, I mean it in a very felt way that has a very strong embodied aspect to it. As we imagine what it was like for them, suddenly we can look back at ourselves in a new kind of way. So I love this kind of thing, and I think it's so important. Oddly enough, the more that we're able through technology to learn about other people, I think in a funny way, we can almost lose our empathic imagination because we don't have to do any work. It's just handed to us on a platter. That's why I think it's so important to continue to engage literature and fiction or to, you know, watch that TV program with your kids and then turn it off and talk about, wow, what could be some of the things those people were feeling and why did they do what they did and what were the conflicts inside them and how might you feel yourself if you had to walk in their shoes?
On a wider level, do you think this sort of thing can stop war? I know this is such a naive question, and it, you know, and I'm not trying to be a hippie idealist about this, but this, I've been thinking about this a lot. Like, if we forget, number one, if we forget what happens then, and number two, if we remember with full embodied empathy, which hundreds and thousands of people are doing every year on war fields pilgrimages, like I did, how does that change anything?
I'm very concerned about these questions as well. I think one aspect of this process of remembrance is to honor those who stood up for us generations ago. And I won't get into the complex issues around a just war and an unjust war and the philosophy of that. It's a little above my pay grade. But I think one reason why we walk through a battlefield or a graveyard is to, you know, is to say thank you. I think a second thing that happens is we start to really appreciate, when we open our hearts to this kind of remembrance, we start to appreciate so many people, including our own young men, typically, and young women increasingly, sent off to fight unnecessary wars. Like, for example, I walked past, I don't know if you've done this, the Vietnam War Memorial in America, and you just see the names of, I forget the numbers, I think it's well over 40,000 names inscribed there. So that form of remembrance is a second form in which we feel the weight of the injustice of our own children being sent off to die or be maimed or be damaged for the rest of their lives in ways that were really uncalled for. And on the basis of that, we do them honor, but we also become motivated. We become outraged in a healthy sense to be stronger the next time some clever person starts playing on our ancient vulnerabilities as tribal creatures to fear and grievance and vengeance. We're very, very vulnerable, and it's so useful, to, I think, to really appreciate that. So anyway, for that reason and for many other reasons, I think the practice of remembrance that you're talking about is critically important. I mean, it's one thing to go through a memorial and kind of shrug and go, wow, and then move on. But it's another to really open your heart and let your heart be moved. That's the essence of empathy, to let yourself be moved, to be affected by what's happened to and or is happening with other people.
Last night, I read an article called The End of Empathy, where the writer was fearful that we're losing the capacity or even the willingness to listen to those outside of our own tribe, as Rick calls it. The universal us, also, that Tom spoke about. That somehow we're devolving by becoming more selective about empathy and wielding it like a weapon to create division instead of unity. And I think she has a point. In this age of siloed discussion and digital pylons, it's just so easy to do a lot of talking but to not listen to others. No more walking in other people's shoes, just your own. A collective sticking of fingers into ears. And isn't that how wars start? For me, the opposite has happened. On this pilgrimage, I'm having conversations with people that the 19-year-old anti-war protesting know-it-all me would have once run a mile from. They're not all easy, but they are all illuminating. War is the ultimate human savagery, Tom said to me when we met in Darwin. And the more I listen, read, imagine, reflect, and walk the ground, as he terms visiting commemorative spaces and places, wherever they might be, the more I feel the weight and responsibility of all those who suffered, served, and sacrificed on whatever side they were on. You just have to join the dots, and none of us live in a vacuum. So for me at least, empathy is key to remembrance, listening deeply to the perspectives and stories of others. So today is Anzac Day. Time to go to the pub, I reckon. Well, the local RSL.
Representing New Zealand Forces and Long Tan veterans, Mr. Ed Cowley.
You're about to meet Mr. Edwin Henry Cowley. It's April 25th. 2018, and Ed's laying a wreath in the Anzac Day dawn service at the Port Noarlunga Christie's Beach RSL Club, just outside of Adelaide in South Australia. The nearby wine coast has become Oliver's and my new home post-Berlin. So this is my new local RSL. Fittingly, it's perched on a cove and you can hear the waves in the background. It's still pretty dark, and I'm in a crowd of 8,000 people, many of whom will soon make their way inside the RSL once the service is over and dawn has broken. What's your name?
Ed Cowley.
And Ed,
How many medals have you got on your chest?
13.
And where did you serve?
Japan, Korea, Malaya, Borneo, Malaysia and Borneo again, and Vietnam twice.
And Vietnam?
Yes. Yeah.
May I ask how old you are?
I'm 83.
So what does it mean to you to come to an Anzac Day Dawn service, having been a serving soldier?
I got to come.
You got to come, yep.
Yeah. My mates are with me.
So your mates who are not here?
Yeah. They're here, and I'm going to march for them. And they'll march with me. Yeah. Sorry, I get...
Please don't apologise. It is an emotional day, isn't it?
If you look up at the RSL's dark wooden honour board, you'll see that Ed's name's there, listed in golden letters a couple of times under the column of President. Ed tells me that he served in two armies for Australia and New Zealand. With great reverence, one of his RSL colleagues tells me that Ed was an FO, an artillery forward observer, in the infamous Battle of Long Tan. So Ed's seen a lot in his army career. He lost a lot of friends too.
So Ed, part of the reason I'm making this series is because I want to know what it means to remember and if remembering can help us prevent war in the future.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think?
War is no good for anyone. We've got to keep this memory going of the people who lost their lives during war, and remember them so that we can prevent wars later on, hoping. But knowing human, we will never stop. There's always going to be a conflict somewhere. And we must preserve the memory of these people who have lost their lives, and we'll never get them back again. And this is the time to say, mate, I'm with you. Wait for me. I'll be there soon.
This memory with you is with you every single day, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's not a day goes without remembering some idea or some incident or something. Yes.
What does it mean to you when you look around and see all of the different people here who come along?
Oh, it's good to see all these people, especially the young ones coming. It's, some of the people just don't know. They come along because it's there. But you look at some of these other young people that are coming through now, their attitude is changing a lot more than the people that grew up, say, in the 70s. The younger people have got a different outlook of life. They see conflict every day, see it on the news, and they know what it's all about. And I think that they're thinking more deeply about remembering than the people in the 70s. All they thought of war was for a chance for them to let off a bit of steam, yelling out and protesting. And it's the people that think deeply into it and know what it's all about will stop wars. We've got to think about them.
So will you enjoy yourself today?
I will once I get over the dawn service. Always catches me at dawn service and after the march. Because at the march, it's not just a march. It's a memorial march. We march with them. They're there. We march with them. I don't care if I'm on my own standing there. I'm really not on my own. I've got mates alongside of me all the time. They're there. And they'll never go away.
Thank you very much, Ed.
Yeah, sorry.
As he was by himself, I stayed a little longer with Ed after I spoke to him. I just wanted to make sure that he wasn't too upset. A few months later, I visit him at his home. He has a very supportive family. The more I talk about it, the better I am, he told me when I asked if I could use his interview. He joined the infantry in 1953 and left the service in 1983, and he still goes down to the RSL on occasion. They don't make it glorified, he said, about talking to other returned veterans. They understand what war is about. Listening to Ed talk this Anzac Day gives me some insight into perhaps what Harry might have gone through as a soldier, trying to come to terms with not only a very different world on his return from World War II, but also about dealing with his emotions, the big, difficult ones that come with the grief and loss in wartime. Unlike Ed, Harry bottled them up and rarely spoke about them, although I did find, again, a rare, very moving passage in his memoir about losing his brother Nathaniel to illness that Harry wrote in the final years of his life. They'd been through so much together as brothers, soldiers, and as prisoners of war.
Unfortunately, Nat passed away on Saturday, the 6th of June 1981, at the age of 69 years. I was with him at Caulfield General Hospital just 15 minutes before he died. He was sitting with his arms around me. He sort of gave me a cuddle and said, nestled into my shoulder, "Goodbye, Ha," as he used to call me when we were kids. I kissed him on the cheek and squeezed him to me, then laid him on the pillows and said goodbye with tears rolling down my cheeks. I can't ever remember him and I showing such affection towards each other, but it was always there, just hadn't come to the surface before. He had a big funeral, and ex-POWs came from as far away as Sale to pay their respects.
I was really proud of Harry that he wrote this.
Ladies and gentlemen, please be seated. That now concludes our ceremony.
So while Anzac Day, of course, is a day to commemorate Australians affected by conflict, looking around me here at the RSL at the hundreds of different types of people, I also realise that it's a day that means different things to different people, and that Anzac Day is changing too, keeping pace with the needs of new generations and an evolving country. And personally, I was stoked to see that the dawn service here at the RSL started with a welcome to country. It made me very proud to be back home in Australia.
Just remember, ladies and gentlemen, breakfast is on.
It also hits me, finally, that Anzac Day is also a day about community, that we're all in this together. The next person I come across here is a politician.
My name's Amanda Rishworth. I'm the Shadow Minister for Veterans Affairs, Defence Personnel, and also the Member for Kingston.
Instead of going on a government-funded trip to commemorate Anzac Day at a place like Gallipoli or Villers-Bretonneux overseas, Amanda chooses instead to come here to the local RSL. I'm intrigued.
Chosen why here? Because I think it's so important to commemorate with your community, and I think the local RSLs, we wouldn't have the type of services available to so many local communities if it wasn't for the local RSLs. So I really think it's important that we support our local commemorative services.
You chose to stay here. The dawn's just come up, and looking around, it's a community event, yeah. Really. Looking around. How does it make you feel?
Look, it makes me feel connected, I think is the right word. Like, I think it's a warmness that our community can come together and to commemorate. I think it is important that we do keep a somber mood about it. I mean, we should be taking that horrific sacrifice that so many made with us through the day. But I think while somber, it is also very heartwarming, I think, that people have come together in such a respectful way. And I think that is an important building block for our community.
So I'm making this project about remembrance, and I've been asking everybody along the way about how important it is to remember the fallen and to remember the wars that we've been involved in. Have you got any thoughts around that?
Look, I think it is really important that we do reflect and remember, because it means that we don't take war and conflict for granted as if something we should just enter into lightly. When we remember, it's not about glorifying war. I mean, the fact that we remember the landing at Gallipoli, which was not successful, shows that we are remembering something more than just winning and losing. It is about the individuals, it's about what they did, it's about the sacrifice that they made, but importantly, how horrible war was, how awful it was, but also that war is it's not something to enter in lightly and should be the last resort.
Part of my investigation or exploration, if you will, is asking, are we actually forgetting a bit about this? Because we tend to remember one day out of the year, but when you look at how our culture is going, more isolation, more individualism, all that sort of thing, and the fact that we are still at war all over the world, including Australia, is still involved in wars, does it really make any difference?
Look, I do think it is important that on Anzac Day so many people come out. But, you know, it is important, though, for our new generation of veterans coming home, I think, that they don't feel like it is just one day that we are thanking them and recognising that. And I think it is important that we continue through our actions as a community, but also through the actions of government, to care and support our veterans through 365 days of the year.
As I leave the RSL, I realise it's the first time I've really gotten Anzac Day. I've found my way into the narrative, and one that's far more interesting, moving and complex than the one I was fed at school as a kid. There was so much left out of it, and maybe that's why Harry never marched. Maybe he felt left out of it too. So today I feel awakened. It's taken a long time and some serious hard work to get here, but it's changed me for the better, I think. I've shed a skin. So now on From a Whisper to a Bang, let's head back to where we started today, to Canberra and the Australian War Memorial, Australia's largest and one of its most revered places of remembrance. And to the office of Dr. Aaron Pegram, a senior historian in the military section there. We meet just as he's finished his PhD, researching Australian prisoners of war on the Western Front between 1916 to 18. It took him a decade and he unearthed some pretty interesting stuff, challenging our ideals about Aussie soldiers in captivity during World War I. My own recent and intense pilgrimage to the Western Front is still very fresh in my mind, discovering the details around the death of Harry's older brother Richard, killed there at 18. I also feel a bit haunted by the paradox of remembering the war to end all wars, knowing we're still fighting them 100 years later. It's hard for me to reconcile. Aaron, however, offers me some deep historian insight into World War I and remembrance of it, and the potential for remembrance to help keep the peace.
You just need to visit the Western Front to get a really good sense of the human toll of the fighting there. I mean, when you go to Tyne Cot Cemetery near Passchendaele, there are 11,000 headstones in this one cemetery. It is quite literally the city of the dead. I mean, you cannot escape the fact that these are men who lost their lives in some of the most atrocious conditions. And you have a look at some of the epitaphs. I think the most poignant one that I've seen on the Western Front is at Villers Bretonneux in France. And it's from a grieving mother. And it just simply says, "My son died for what?" There is an essence of futility about the fighting on the Western Front. There's also a flip side to it. The British Army and the French forces were not going to eject the Germans from France and neutral Belgium just by sitting on their hands. I think it's really important to remember and to look at that sort of human toll. I mean, 60,000 Australian war dead. I mean, that's the size of Wagga. I mean, just dead, not to mention the wounded and those who were, you know, mentally affected by the war, not to mention the alcoholism or the domestic violence that went on for decades afterwards. I mean, by understanding the First World War and understanding how the components that go into, looking at war within a historical context, you learn those lessons and you then provide the material, you help people understand what they are so that these things don't get perpetrated down the line.
The Australian soldiers Aaron writes about in his thesis don't quite live up to our traditional notions of the Anzac legend. So I'm curious, how does he define his role as an historian?
My job as a historian is to remain
factual and accurate to, you know, the historical documents and to what actually took place. So what I see my role is to challenge the past, challenge our perceptions about what the First World War, what aspects of our military history are like. I mean, particularly with my research, my thesis directly challenges the notion that Australians were great soldiers. You know, they weren't always excellent soldiers. These men threw away their rifles and stuck up their hands and willingly surrendered to the Germans. They openly talked to German interrogators. That's not an essence of mateship. They actually revealed information that adversely affected their comrades in the field. And, you know, when they were in captivity, they weren't emasculated sort of soldiers who were brutally treated by their captors. In fact, they still considered themselves very masculine soldiers. They took pride in their appearance. They went out and...
You know, on dates.
They went out on dates and more.
So my part of the focus of this project is I'm posing the question, you know, lest we forget, what happens if we do, and are we forgetting? But maybe there's a little addendum to this. What if we misuse remembering?
I think, you know, lest we forget, of course, you know, we commemorate service and sacrifices of the 106,000 Australians who have died on active service and other operations since the Boer War. But also, lest we forget what actually occurred. I mean, we don't need national myths, national legends to make ourselves feel good or to carry a political agenda, because the historical events is quite a remarkable story. It actually shows what a country can do unified with a single purpose and how they can help remove a hostile, totalitarian force from another country that prides itself on liberal democracy. I mean, it's quite a fascinating story, and I don't think we need the notions of mateship and larrikinism to make it a better story. It's fantastic the way it is.
So where does peace factor into your work? Do you think what you research and your role here at the War Memorial, keeping these stories alive, being historically, factually accurate, do you think that can somehow make a difference to prevent another war from happening?
Absolutely. There was a period between Vietnam and the 2000s where we had a very long period of peace. Particularly here in Australia. I mean, there was a long part in our military history where the Australian forces weren't deployed overseas to take part in an armed conflict. And within that time, I think we kind of forgot about how horrible wars can be. And in some respects, we've had to relearn that, particularly with the recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I think in doing so, the War Memorial sort of goes some way in telling people and showing people what those wars are like. I mean, we redeveloped our First World War gallery to coincide with the wave of public interest in the centenary of Gallipoli in 2015. And in that gallery, it's quite confronting. I mean, there are watercolors and plaster of Paris molds of an Australian soldier who had half his face blown off. It's a confronting display about how horrible wars can be. I think that's where peace comes into it.
So, yeah, how do we remember well or remember better are the questions I walk away with after listening to Aaron. How do we turn every day into Anzac Day? How might we build the gratitude and acknowledgement and that sense of community that we practice on Anzac Day every year, once a year, into something that we might do much more often, something in our daily lives? I'm not sure, but I am hoping that I might be able to find some answers to those questions just outside of Aaron's window, with the people who made and are visiting the memorial's gigantic and quite brilliant Red Sea of Poppies. Hello, ladies. May I ask your opinion on what you think of the poppy display here? You're all invited to speak.
Honey just arrived, but yeah. We think it's quite awesome just looking up amongst...
Fantastic walking in. Yeah. It really does. Yeah.
Have you got any connection to the wars?
Yes. Well, my father died of war wounds, so yeah.
Do you think it's good to have these sorts of acts of remembrance, public remembrance?
Well, I think it is, because it brings it to the next generation and the ones after that they gave their lives, yeah. Really.
So what does this bring up for you when you look at this sea of poppies?
It's very beautiful. It just makes you think, I guess,
about how many people died.
The poppies are very individual.
Does that bring up any emotional tone with you?
I'm actually feeling a bit emotional now, yeah. Thinking about someone knitting something for a lost son or a lost father.
Oh, well, it's a remembrance for the fallen. And yes. My parents and my grandparents were lucky enough not to be involved with any of that, so we haven't got any of the history, personal history. But the children want to be here and we want to be here.
Yeah. You think it's important to remember?
Of course, because they were so convinced that what they were doing was so right and so many lives were lost.
My name's Judy Barter and I come from Queensland, originally from Sydney. And my grandfather and his three brothers fought in the First World War.
And what are we sitting out the front of at the moment?
Oh, the delightful poppy display.
You're wearing a poppy scarf, you've got a poppy brooch on, and you've come a long way to practice remembrance, that's by the sounds of it.
That's right,
Why is that?
Well, I think it's very important, and I notice at the last post ceremonies that we've been attending lately that the school children come, and I think that's a wonderful thing to bring it up with the children for the remembrance of those that gave their lives for us.
So what goes through your head when you look at something like this?
Well, the sacrifice that's been given for us and our country. Still, it's very overwhelming, still very emotional. We had my son flew down. Nephews came from Sydney, brother from Maruya, for the ceremony last Sunday, and the War Memorial couldn't have done a better job.
And who were you commemorating?
We were commemorating my great uncle Arthur Herbert Smith, whom my father was named after, and he also went to the Second World War, but Arthur Herbert Smith gave his life at 23 years of age at Bapaume in France.
Is it healing for you in some way to do this pilgrimage?
I think that's a good word. I think that's a good word. I think it sort of brings you closer to your ancestors. And particularly, you know, we weren't told anything as growing up, you know. War was something that wasn't to be talked about. For me to know is meant a lot.
Meredith, who you met earlier, and her friend Gay are two of the Poppy volunteers. And for them, the Poppy Project, while one about remembrance, also involves a sense of empathy and connection.
I also had a feeling while I was knitting that I had a connection to all of the women, the mothers, the wives, the girlfriends who knitted the socks and the balaclavas and the scarves.
Absolutely.
For their loved ones over on the Western Front in those terribly bitter, cold, muddy winters. So there was that connection as well. So many layers of connection and of remembrance and of community. It's been a truly, truly wonderful experience that I feel honoured and privileged to have been involved in.
Absolutely. What crossed your mind, Gay, when you were crocheting or knitting poppies, maybe in the quieter moments?
Well, probably a little bit like Meredith and probably like every other woman. I had a goal, a number that I wanted to create for the family members that I knew who hadn't come home. And I loved the sense of connection, not just with our past, but with our present. Because as I was making, when my granddaughter would come to stay, we would knit together and I'd taught her to knit. I was able to tell her the story of some of our family members, and I thought, we are now handing on the legacy of what we've done and why we've done it to the next generation. And so it's that connection that really touched me.
Letty Rowe is the Canberra coordinator for the 62,000 Poppies Project. In the army herself for 39 years, she comes from a big defence family. The project enabled many people to research their own family members' service and represented all conflicts and operations that Australia has been involved in, from the Boer War right up to Afghanistan. Being part of this remembrance project means a lot to her.
It enables singular people to have a moment of reflection and make something that then becomes part of a whole. Each poppy is a person, a family member, someone's brother, sister, and go through all that range, husband, son.
So looking at this giant sea of poppies, I mean, it's very beautiful and it looks quite joyful. But when you know the story, it's actually pretty sad, isn't it? There's a lot of loss represented over there, isn't there?
This is our nation's loss. So all these individuals never came home and their potential was cut. So even though it is a sadness, it's commemorating their loss after 100 years, and it is understanding that without them, we wouldn't have what we have.
What do you think the role of remembrance is? Do you think it's an important thing to practice?
People take for granted what we have. So if you can remember and commemorate those who gave us our freedoms, who gave us our rights, who gave us our abilities to be the best we can be, of course it's important. So, yeah, remembrance is important.
Are we forgetting?
We have a lot going on in our current lives. There's a lot of social media. There's a lot of white noise, a moment of solemnness and a moment where you just pause in that moment of quiet and just go, the art of slow, just take it slow and just remember. It's worthy, it's a worthy thing.
When you get up close to the poppies, you can see that each flower is entirely unique. They're not all Flanders red with black in the middle. Many have purple centres representing the animals of war. Others are white, remembering nurses. And then there are those that are black, red and yellow, representing the service and sacrifice of Indigenous servicemen and women in the Australian Armed Forces. The remembrance of whom I'll be exploring next episode on From a Whisper to a Bang, and the important restoration and recovery work going on around this once forgotten and neglected aspect of Australia's military history. Looking at this sea of poppies reveals the broader story of Australia's war remembrance, as does the massive carpet of 270,000 woolen flowers that appears a month later at Parliament House at the opposite end of Anzac Parade for the centenary of Armistice. Another spectacular and public reminder that when it comes to commemoration of war, it's not best we forget, but lest we forget. Speaking today on From a Whisper to a Bang were Dr. Tom Lewis, Dr. Rick Hansen, Ed Cowley, Amanda Rishworth MP, Dr. Aaron Pegram, Poppy Pilgrims, Susan, Chantelle, Jennifer, Heather and Judy Barter, and Poppy Makers Meredith Attilamile, Gabe Broadbent and Letty Rowe. You also heard the voices of Dr. Brendan Nelson, Lynn Berry, Darren Dash Moyle and Heath Big. From a Whisper to a Bang is a podcast produced and presented by me, Megan Spencer, for the Australian War Memorial. Series music is by renowned Cretan Australian duo Zulurus White, with additional music from The Digger's Requiem, a musical collaboration arranged, curated and conducted by Chris Latham, musical artist in residence at the Australian War Memorial. Additional sound by Jeremy Conlon, with additional music by Michael Sheriffs and the magnificent Canberra City pipes and drums that you can hear right now. Mastering is by Chris Keogh. War Comes to Australia Newsreel, courtesy of CineSound Movietone Productions. A big thank you to the Port Noarlunga Christie's Beach RSL, the Poppy Ladies, the staff at the memorial, and everyone involved in this episode. For the full list of credits, thank yous and acknowledgements, please visit the From a Whisper to a Bang page on the Australian War Memorial website, awm.gov.au. You can also find more episodes of this podcast there, and you can subscribe to it on your favourite podcast app. Thank you very much again for listening. I look forward to speaking to you again next episode.